Thank you, Randy. Well, we're going to start to get into the meat and potatoes of the book of Romans this morning and why the Apostle Paul wrote this book in the first place. Last week we had our first lesson and it was just kind of an introduction of the book of Romans, and Paul was introducing himself as a bondservant of Jesus Christ. I mean, he tied himself to Christ just the first shot out of the barrel, you might say. He was just saluting them, saying how much he appreciated them, telling them that he always prayed for them. And down in verse 16, then he starts to transition from his salutation into why he's writing this letter in the first place. In verse 16, this familiar passage of Scripture, you've heard it all of your church-going life. He says, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation, to the Jew first, and also for the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed, from faith to faith, the just shall live by faith." I don't think there's any doubt about it. As you study the book of Romans, it becomes very obvious that the subject of this book is the just shall live by faith. And one of the most important things that we can take away from the study of the book of Romans, I think, is to learn how, first of all, is to learn who are the just. The English Standard Version says the righteous. They say the righteous shall live by faith. It's the same thing. Those who are justified to God are those who are righteous. And so the just shall live by faith. So one of the greatest takeaways we can have, I think, from a study of this great book is to learn what it means, what it truly means to live by faith. And I think we all could sit here this morning and say, "Well, I live by faith. I have faith in God." But do we really? Do we really trust Him? Are we all in? Do we give Him all? Do we trust His Word? Do we trust His Word to provide us with our needs, even though we do not understand what's going on with us at some particular time, but yet we continue to trust Him? Accordingly, this book kind of naturally falls into two sections, like most of Paul's letters do. Chapters 1 through 11, he kind of explains what are the just, who are the righteous, who are these people. And I'm going to use just and righteous, understand, just interchangeably here completely. Who are the just? What does it take to be righteous, to be just? And then the second part of the book, from chapter 12 through chapter 16, he teaches us how to live by faith. First, the just shall live by faith, or who are the just, and then how do the just live by faith. And to launch these first two sections, Paul identified two things from which we all need to be saved. One is ungodliness, and two is unrighteousness. And he kind of draws a contrast between the two, ungodliness and unrighteousness. He kind of goes here and he talks about the ancient Gentiles or the pre-Christian Gentiles as being absolutely ungodly, but then he comes back and lays into his Jewish brothers and sisters as being unrighteous. And that starts in chapter 2. So we're going to begin with verse 18 then. But he proceeded to use the immoral Gentiles in his day. And you have to understand that when Paul was writing this letter to Rome, in those capital cities of Athens and Rome, it was just decadence. All kinds of sexual immorality was taking place. Violence was happening. Justice could scarcely be found from the powers that be, from the courts of the day. I almost said anarchy, but it wasn't anarchy in such a state, but it was just ungodliness everywhere that you look. And the Jews were just as guilty as the Gentiles. And we'll see that as we go along this morning. He proceeded to use the immoral Gentiles of the day as an example of ungodliness in verse 19 through 32, and his insensitive Jewish peers as an example of unrighteousness. And that's in chapter 2, verses 1 through 10 or 16. And in doing so, he proved that with the gospel, any of us can be saved from our past sins. So the title of this lesson is, and I think the title of this entire series is Justified. It's a play on words. Justified, never sinned. But this is justified, never sinned, despite my past. And he's talking to Gentiles and Jews alike here. So he goes on in verse 18 and he says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness." I said a few minutes ago, he identifies two things from which everyone needs to be saved. We do today, just as those sinful people did back then. Ungodliness and unrighteousness. Unrighteousness is anytime we're walking outside of the will of God in our daily lives, we can consider ourselves to be unrighteous. Those are unrighteous acts that we're doing, that we're taking place with. Ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. I can't tell you how much commentary there is that's written on verse 18 here. It's a very interesting verse. He goes on in verse 19, though, "Because what may be known of God is manifest in them." He's talking about the Gentiles here. The pre-Christian world Gentiles may be going back even to the pre-flood people. I don't know, but but he says, "Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it in them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools." So this is a reference to the fact that the pre-Christian Gentile world, remember we said last week that even though there were Jews and Gentiles in the church at Rome, Paul considered the church at Rome largely a Gentile church, a Gentile congregation. And so he's showing them here that the Gentiles need salvation just the same as anyone else. This is a reference to the fact that the pre-Christian Gentile world had the truth and they suppressed it, he said, and denied it through their sins and their wickedness. I think verse 18 is a most interesting verse because it begs the question of just how much of God's truth did the pre-Christian Gentile world know, and they suppressed it. You know, that's what he's saying here. He's saying, you all knew God. You knew him. So, you know, let's think about this for just a minute. In the very person of Adam and Eve, in the Garden of Eden, they knew God. They worshiped God. They spoke with God. God spoke with them. God punished them. God blessed them. God punished them. But for more than 1,000 years, the antediluvian period or the pre-flood years, for more than 1,000 years, there was no God's chosen people. All the people knew God. They knew God. God continually handed down the method by which he wanted to be worshiped. He continually sent down messages to the people in those days. But yet they became so abominably corrupt that God decided to just wipe out everyone and start all over during that time. But they knew God. Now, we have to remember, too, that the Jewish nation did not begin until Abraham. So up until that time as well, after the flood years, people knew God. And they worshiped God. I mean, for thousands of years in the history of the world, before Abraham, the people were largely monotheistic, and they honored God and they revered God in those years. The wrath of God was upon the Jews and the Gentiles alike for having let that go. And he says there in that verse 18, he said, "Who suppressed the truth in unrighteousness." We can do the same thing. Suppressing the truth doesn't really mean that you just put it out of your mind, but rather you overwhelm the truth. We overwhelm the truth sometimes that's in us with unrighteousness by getting involved in things that we shouldn't be involved in, doing things that we shouldn't be doing, and that's what he's lodging against these Gentiles. He's talking about them. How do we know that he is predominantly talking about the Gentiles here, the pre-Christian Gentile world? Because he's using the words them. He's using the word those. Because now he is a Jew. And in chapter 2, when he starts talking predominantly to the Jews, he talks about we and us. So we can see here, and all of the commentators, all of religious scholarship believe this same thing, and you can read as many as you want to. Albert Barnes, Adam Clark, Burton Kaufman, you know, the list goes on and on and on. And they all say that he is here addressing the Gentiles about their activity before. And so he goes on to tell them, you know, just to begin with, all they had to do is just look around the world that I created for them. Look at what he says there in verse 20. For since the create, well, verse 19, because of what may be known of God is manifest to them. In other words, it's been shown to them. For God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. You know, what does that say to you when you read that? Somebody, when you read that, and you look around, and you see now, you know, just a little while ago, the leaves were on the trees. We were mowing our yards, trimming our hedges. And then just almost suddenly now the leaves are gone. And this morning it is cold and the frost is on the roofs. And that's almost a phenomenon. But it's not a phenomenon because in time it will come back around next year, if the Lord is willing and the world is still standing then. And we'll see the same thing again. And so it goes on year after year. And it won't be any time until the buttercups will be blooming and we'll see the beauty of the dogwood trees and the little red buds peeping out from the peeping out from the shrubberies on the sides of the roads and things. Just a beautiful, beautiful time. The blue sky and the fluffy clouds and all of these things. And I'm particularly avoiding the tornadoes here. But they happen. They're a natural occurrence in the system that God set forth when He created the earth. They're a natural occurrence. It's just something that it's a condition that just happens. But when we see this, Paul is saying, in the sense of God, you should be able to see me. You should know I'm here. Yes, just to look
God
at. He did, and us. Yeah, and we just must be able to see Him in that creation, and that's what Paul is reinforcing to these Gentiles here. He said, because although they knew God, he's saying, you know, they knew God, and they did. They did not glorify Him as God, though. They stopped holding Him up as God. Nor were they thankful to Him, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. What he's saying here primarily is the people just suppressed God. They just wanted to push Him out of their mind. So many people today, we see so many people, and I hear people making speeches, and I hear their speeches about pro-choice. I hear those speeches about LGBTQ, and now there's something else, X or something's been added, I hear their speeches in support of these movements in our country, and you have to listen to it and think, you are suppressing what you must know to be true, that there is a God and that God has spoken to mankind. But we must know that. And if we deny that, then we're suppressing it in deference to being able to do what we want to do. That's easy, right? Just say to myself, there is no God. Now I can do anything I want to do. But you can't. It's kind of like tearing down all of these statues. And I don't want to get into another subject there, but I think the history is still what it is. You can destroy anything you want to destroy, but you cannot destroy the history. It's there, and it will not change. What happened yesterday is forever memorialized in yesterday, and you cannot change it. You might do something to improve it, but you can't change it. But anyway, I digress there. And so then on in verse 23, let's go back to 22 and see if we can pick up the thought here. Professing to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of an incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man. He's talking about idolatry here. And it's true. In the history of Roman and Greek mythology and Apollo and Zeus and Jupiter and all of those gods that they worshipped, that they made statues to and formulated in their own, the minds of their philosophers and one thing and another, they created, rather than continuing to worship and honor monotheistically an incorruptible God, they took images that He had created and made gods out of those images. And that's what Paul is pointing out here in a very graphic way. You know, he says, you know, how short-sighted is that? You turned against an incorruptible God to start to worship images of corruptible man. And then he says in verse 24 and 25, therefore God also gave them up to uncleanness in the lust of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves, I'm not ready for that just yet. But the frustration and the anger and the retaliation of Satan are certainly evident in the idolatry that's described by Paul here. If God caused Satan to become a serpent and crawl on his belly, then Satan in retaliation would certainly cause God to become the same. And that's what Satan had done in the Gentile world, had caused God to become these images and idols. And as far as he says, and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things, as far as four-footed animals and creeping things are concerned, since the beginning of time, there has been someone somewhere who has worshipped everything at one time or another. There's been rats have been worshipped. I mean, everything. I've said before, and it's not original, I read this somewhere, that it is inborn in us. It's a human attribute to worship. Human beings want to worship something. And if they and failing to find the proper thing to worship, they will. Did anybody ever see that movie? What was it with Tom Hanks? Shipwrecked? Castaway. It was Castaway. Yeah, he was on this desert island. And he was worshiping a soccer ball that he called Wilson. You remember that? It's mankind's nature to want to worship. And that's just built into us. And so if we suppress God, then we'll find something else to worship just the same. Anybody got any comments? Okay. Yes. Well, we glorify God in the things that we do. I think the things that we do, you know, when I believe that when a man goes to work or a woman goes to work to earn, to take care of their family, I think we're glorifying God because that's a job that we have to do. I think when we're taking care of our family, when we're looking after others, when we're calling others to see if they're sick or well, if we haven't seen them for a while, we're glorifying God in doing those kinds of things. We glorify God when we do good because we worship Him. So that's the way we can glorify God. And then, you know, you're glorifying God by being here today. Amen? I don't think there's any doubt about that. You went to the trouble, or maybe it wasn't trouble for you. Maybe it's just this is what we do on the Lord's Day. We plan to gather together to worship God. We plan to gather together to learn more about Him and think about eternal things for just a little while. But we're glorifying God here today. Thank you for the question. It's just that's a good question to think about for sure. Yes. Absolutely, yes. Yeah, that's right. I think you're right, absolutely. Thank you. Anyone else? Then in verse 24, he says, therefore, after he says all these things, they suppressed the truth. They knew the truth. They knew that God, they knew I was here. They knew all the time. They've seen the world that I created. They've seen their own selves that I created. They've seen all of this. Plus, I spoke with them, you know. God spoke through the patriarchs to the world for generations. And And so they knew about God, the whole world. And but he's saying the Gentile world suppressed the truth. And then in verse 24 it says, therefore. And you know what therefore means. When you, every time you see the word therefore, you need to look and see what it's there for. Well, it's there for just all of the things that we just talked about. God also gave them up to uncleanness in the lust of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves, to exchange the truth of God for a lie, and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. You know, I wish that the whole world was listening to this lesson right now, and somebody that was better at presenting it than I am to be up here talking, to just see what God said right here in the next three or four verses. That you know, it just, this thing about exchanging the truth of God for a lie is going back to what I said just a little while ago. If you just get up one morning and you decide there's not a God, there's just not one. So I can just go forward and I can do whatever I want to. I'll try not to hurt anybody. I'll try not to disturb anybody's sleep. I'll try not to destroy their property. But other than that, I can do anything that I want to do, and I'll be within my rights to do so. So they exchanged the truth of God for a lie, because that's a lie. We just can't live any way that we want to, because we're going to pay the price for that one day. Plus, it does not glorify God. It glorifies Satan when we do according to his will. So there was nothing passive in God's giving up those ancient people. I'm not sure, and I have, somebody can help me here, I guess, but I've combed the scriptures and the scholarship to find out exactly who he's talking about here. And I don't know if he's talking about the antediluvian world or what, but he gave up the Gentiles because they turned against him. And so I want to believe that he's talking about all of the pre-Christian Gentiles here. He gave them up because we know that the Gentile world in the time of Christ was pagan. They were just pagan. They worshiped. They were idolatrous. They were sexually immoral in the name of their worship. In the name of their worship. And so he says, God gave them up to uncleanness. Literally translated, he handed them over. Handed them over to Satan. He handed them over. And I think this is one of the most sobering studies in all of the Bible. In the lust of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves. And then he gets more graphic than that. Who exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. You know, in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 12, Paul writes, for it is shameful even to speak of those things which are done by them in secret. And he's talking about the same people to the Ephesians there. It's shameful to even speak of them. Therefore, as Paul is often does, he lists a great catalog of sins. There's this, and those who practice such things will not see the kingdom of God. And we're going to see one right here in verse 29 through 31, 21 things that he's listed right down here. But I think one of the reasons that none of these things are entered here is because of what he said. It is shameful even to speak of those things which are done by them in secret. God gave them up. It means more than just merely a removal of the providential restraint that I think we all have. Don't you think that there's built into human beings, it's built into us, a certain respect for other human beings and a need to help them if they're in trouble, just to stop by and see what's going on, if they need any help or something like that. we probably don't do it enough, but I think it's built into us, this care for other people. But it doesn't just mean that he just removed that hand of providence from the lives of the wrongdoers. For there is included a conscious requirement or a conscious thought of God that the sinner is just compelled to go forward with what they want to do regardless of their thought about God and giving glory to him in their lives. It's kind of like what the case of Judas, who received the sentence from Christ. In John 13, verse 7, Jesus told him, he said, "What you do, do quickly." In other words, he said, "I know what you're going to do. Just go ahead and do it. Go ahead and do it." And another example of that, too, was the case of Balaam, you know, when he struck his donkey three times because the donkey was trying to tell him that God does not want you to go forward with these men. And then finally, he said, "I'll go back." And God said, "No, just go with the men." He gave him up. He said, "Just go with them. Go ahead and go with them. That's what you want to do." So this is not to say, though, that God causes people to do wrong. Far from it. C.H. Lenski, who is a very learned scholar and educator, wrote this. He said, "This is more than permission to fall into uncleanness, and it is less than causing this fall. God's action is judicial. At first, God always restrains by moral persuasion, by legal and other hindrances. But when God is completely cast off, when the measure of ungodliness overflows, his punitive justice hands the sinner over completely to their sins in order to let the sins run to excess and destroy the sinner." So this is when our sin becomes our punishment. And we're going to see that here in just the next verse, in verse 26, or the next verse or two. He says, "For this reason God gave them," this is the second time now out of six times that he says God gave them up. Turned them over. He handed them over to Satan. "For this reason, God gave them up to vile passions, for even their women exchanged the natural use for what is against nature. Likewise, also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lusts, one for another, men with men committing what is shameful and receiving in themselves the penalty of their error, which was due." Now, I don't want you to notice that. He said, burns in their lusts, one men with men, receiving in themselves the penalty of the error, which was due. In other words, he just let them go and let them reap the rewards of what they're doing, reap the punishment of what they're doing. And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting, being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covet. And this is that catalog of sins. That's 21, I think I counted, if I counted right. Being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness. They were our whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, discerning, untrusting, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful. What a list. Who, knowing the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things are deserving of death, not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them. So not only do they engage in these abominable things, but they approve of the others that do them too, and they want to bring more people into the fold. I mean, this is a lesson for our society today, but so many will say to you, you know, don't you know that God has said through His Word? They will say, well, that's your God. That's not my God. You know, in other words, they have, what was the word? They have dismissed God. You know, they knew God at one time, but they've dismissed Him. Sharon. And He says that. Yeah. In chapter 2 and verse 1, He says, and you are out without excuse, O man, too. And then He starts talking about we. He starts talking to the Jews. And He said, you've been condemning them. Who do you think you are to condemn them when you're guilty of the same thing they're guilty of? And just as much of it. So you're absolutely right, Sharon. They were absolutely guilty of all the same things. And we're running out of time. But I appreciate all your comments. Is there anyone else? I love those. It makes us think of things that I didn't think about. I try to think about everything, but I just can't do it. Can't do it. I'm old. But in these verses, in the preceding verses, he talks about sexual deviation in general. And then he talks about homosexuality specifically. He talks about it, and he condemns it. And then people will say, and I've shared this with you before, I had a fellow that I worked with at St. Thomas one time, very smart guy. He had a master's degree in healthcare administration. He was a registered nurse, very smart guy. He was on the leadership team, but he was gay. He was married, and he had a wife, and he had two children, one handicapped son, and they lived in a nice house out in Brentwood. But he decided one day he was gay, and his defense to me was, how can God condemn me for being like He made me? That was his defense. And I said, whoa. And I quoted a little James to him. James said, let not you say when you are tempted that you were tempted of God, because God cannot be tempted, nor does He tempt any man, but you are tempted when you are drawn away by your own lusts and enticed. And he thought about it. He said, I'm going to think about that. And I said, you think about that. But he moved to California after that, and I never heard from him again. I can't find him, or the people that we knew haven't been in touch with him. That's right. Yeah. Well, I said that, you know, I told him, everybody is like God made them. And I'm not holding myself up. I mean, I got easily besetting sins just like everybody else. But I said, everybody's like God made them. Some people have a propensity or toward addiction, you know, and others are even, they have they steal things. They're not a thief. You wouldn't call them a thief, but it's a mental, kleptomania. They just pick things up in a store. But the thing is, it's not what you're tempted to do, it's whether or not you do it. You got to just keep going back to God's Word. But thank you so much. Our time is up. And I want to pick this up again next week and go on through this. I was going to go through chapter 2 and verse 10 today, but I appreciate so much. You don't know how much I appreciate your comments. It just makes the class so much richer, and it introduces discussion that wouldn't have been introduced otherwise. So if you would, read, you know, just read through the first three or four chapters of Romans. Maybe read through it a couple of times and jot down a question or a comment or something you want to make before next Lord's Day. But I appreciate your presence this morning and your kind attention to these things, and class is dismissed.